We are whistle ready at the Quick Restart Podcast. Like that? Whistle ready.
Thank you for coming back to the Inside Lacrosse Podcast. I am Terry Foy, joined at long last by Quint Kestner. Quint, I missed you last week. You were on the ESPN selection show laying out the 16-team bracket. We talked to committee chair Tim Leonard, the Towson athletic director, as well as a handful of coaches. But it's been 2 weeks since you and I got an opportunity to talk lacrosse for the people to listen. And of course, we are going to react to the first round of the NCAA tournament. But first things first, we are staring down the barrel at the quarterfinals. How are you doing this morning?
Good morning, class. Good afternoon or evening, whenever you're listening to this. If you watched the game late on Sunday night, follow me, please. Breathe in through the nose, out through the mouth. In through the nose, out through the mouth, okay? I had to do multiple savasanas last night to be able to fall asleep after what was one of the most amazing playoff games that I have watched in a while that had so much tension and action that I couldn't settle down. I was shaking.
Let's start there and just dive into that game. The Loyola Greyhounds head out to Peter Barton Stadium to take on the number 7 seed Denver Pioneers. Loyola had their Patriot League championship game against Lehigh canceled last Sunday due to a positive COVID test. They were on a 4-game win streak heading into that. Wins over Georgetown, Navy in the Patriot League quarters, and Army in the Patriot League semis catapulted them into an at-large spot. I wrote an article early in the week about the 48 hours of chaos, essentially going from the jubilation of the win over Army to the heartbreak of having to cancel and withdraw from the Patriot League tournament into, once again, that combination of relief and excitement for the opportunity to practice again for another 5 days, travel out to Denver, and take on the Pioneers. Denver, certainly one of the teams of the season, given the transferring in of Jackson Morrill and Lucas Kotler over the offseason from Yale, and then the midseason transferring in of T.D. Erland. This game was pretty slow to start. It was 2-2 at the end of the first quarter, and then Loyola opened it up with a quick 3-goal spurt to start the second quarter to build a 5-2 lead, and from there, they managed to extend it over the course of the second quarter, took a 9-4 lead into halftime, and oh my goodness, did the Pioneers respond at the beginning of the third quarter with 3 quick goals and ultimately cutting it to 1 by the end of the third. And from there, it set up an uber-dramatic fourth. Quint, can you describe the ultimate play to this game?
Well, the game had more than just the final save, but you know, it was chaotic the end of the game with the amount of penalties and some of the clock and score management situations with Loyola having the ball, getting double teamed, taking a shot, missing the net, turning it over, the rush clear, and then no timeout by Denver. And, you know, when you think about giving up a shot, that's not exactly the one you want to give up. And it was a point blank shot, good fakes, but Sam Schaefer made the save. I think it hit him in the helmet. And anytime, Terry, I got a lot of things to say. Anytime someone's comparing goalies at one of your events, one of your IL summer events, 5'9 kid versus a 6-foot kid, and they're about equal, go with the 6-foot kid. This save by Sam Schaefer was the classic example of why bigger goalies are better. They just fill up the net more. And was he beat? Well, he held his ground pretty well. His stick was beat, but his body was there to save. One of the epic saves that I can remember in NCAA tournament play. I will go back to your article, which I thought was one of the better things that I've read all spring. It was terrific because it had the human side of what Loyola was dealing with. And I think it explains their performance. You know, one of the keys to winning playoff games is operating with no fear. You can have no fear of losing. You can have no fear of making a mistake. And given that second chance, I mean, this is like a reincarnation of this team. It's a rebirth. It's a free run, so to speak, too. And they're kind of like living on a prayer. I heard Bon Jovi living on a prayer this morning. And like they're given this opportunity. It's like, hey, we just got to run with it. You know, there's the pressure is off. The tension is cut. It's really a free roll for them. And I thought they played that way offensively all day. They took some chances. They shot the ball really, really well, and they held on. I mean, they were gassed at the end. That game, Denver's offense, well, I don't think they're great 6-on-6. That scheme, like, punches at you, punches at you, punches at you, and things tend to open up late in the game, and it did. Denver took, I don't know, 30 shots in the second half, and Loyola was clearly on the ropes late.
One of the aspects of that, for sure, was the faceoff performance, and T.D. Erland really took over in the second half. He finished the game 17-19. Alex Dathakis won 6 of 11, taking roughly a third of the draws. Bailey Savio really battled. He finished 7 for 29 and picked up 4 ground balls. One point I want to make with respect to the final shot. So you mentioned Loyola, out of a timeout, takes a shot. It's backed up, which was a really creative thing. And then,
yeah, but the problem was that Loyola player should have picked the ball up immediately on the restart.
Right.
And got the fast whistle before Denver could have called timeout. And that way he would have had a one-on-one in the corner. He fumbles around back in the corner looking for a ball. And next thing you know, Denver can bring the double over there. They call timeout. And you basically just kill 3 seconds for a negative outcome.
Aiden Olmstead restarted the out of the Denver timeout and basically just threw the ball behind the goal, and there was a scramble that lasted so there was 31 seconds left coming out of the second timeout after the Loyola clear, the Denver timeout. The ball crossed the midline after having gone out of bounds once. Jack Hanna carried the ball over the midline with roughly 10 seconds left. He carried down the left alley, drew two, got into a scoring position, and just laid the ball off in a really nice spot to Alex Simmons, who caught it at GLE in the low righty corner. Talking to Sam Schaefer after the game, he mentioned that Simmons didn't have much of an angle. He had to get in front of the crease, and he did, kind of unencumbered. By the time he got to the point in the crease where he had full view of the goal, he was starting to get a little bit of contact, but he let go of a shot. And to your point, yeah, he hit Schaefer in the upper body. He immediately reacted. The ball was still scrambled. He took the shot with 4 seconds left, and ultimately, I believe it was Matt Higgins who came up with the ground ball and chucked it to the other end of the field to allow Loyola to celebrate. But one point that I want to make about this, there were saves in the final 2 seconds of every quarter from both teams. So Schaefer finished with 16 saves. Jack Thompson finished with 7. Not a great percentage given that he allowed 14 goals. But he made a stop with 1 second left in the third quarter that was almost as remarkable. I mean, it was Loyola got the ball back with like 3 seconds left, managed this full field clear, and I believe it was Evan James who got off an incredible look that Thompson just swiped. So this was a game in which really punctuated the theme throughout the weekend of excellent goaltending. But I think the point that you made about Denver's offense and the way that they wore down Loyola's defense had so much to do with the faceoff game and the fact that even when Loyola scored, I mean, they scored 3 times in the fourth quarter in order to maintain their lead, it still wasn't much relief because at that point it meant Denver was immediately getting the ball back.
Yeah, no, this game was won in the second quarter, as you said. Again, if you look at the score by quarter, it's basically even first and fourth quarters. Loyola wins the second quarter 7-2. Denver wins the third quarter 6-2. But I thought the goalie differential in this game was clear. Sam Schaefer, a unanimous decision, gets the victory as the better goalie. He gave up no soft goals. He handled the ball well. He made the big stop at the end.
It is now officially Maverick May Madness on InsideLacrosse.com. And the new Maverick EKG shoulder pads and chest protector are here for all players. Get upgraded performance protection that meets the new Noxy safety standards. Shop the whole line on lax.com/EKG. All right. In terms of organizing this podcast going forward, we're going to talk about all 8 games, well, 7 at this point. And
did you email me the format? Because I haven't opened it yet.
I'm pretty confident that we can do this one without email, given that
we got a bracket, and that provides a great format.
Exactly.
I tell our producer the selection show every year, they give us this like 7-page format, and I'm like, wait a second, let's just work off the bracket. It's pretty easy.
So I think the second most newsworthy outcome of the weekend was Virginia's survival against Bryant in Charlottesville on Sunday afternoon. You know, this was a game in which they built a 3-1 early lead, and Bryant swung right back and took a 10-8 lead late in the third quarter. Virginia got one back, and then that was part of a four-goal spurt. Coach Mike Pressler talked post-game about how his team played 45 minutes, but in order to win a playoff game, you got to play a full 60, and they weren't able to do that in Klockner Stadium. And despite a really good effort from faceoff specialist Jacob Alexander, there was so much about the way in which Virginia's offense settled in, played with composure. The five-point outings, two goals and three assists apiece from Matt Moore and Connor Schellenberger, showed the versatility in playmaking. Both guys talked about how they were both not ready and confused by Bryant's four-man box zone when Virginia tried to attack from behind, which is a compelling thing to hear at this stage of the season. But at the other end, you know, Virginia did a really nice job on ground balls, and Alex Rode made 18 saves, once again, keeping up with that theme of goalies being the difference over the course of the weekend.
Welcome to the shot clock era where you know good teams are going to get shots in their 80 seconds, so goalies can't run and hide. I thought Alex was really good early and really good late. The Virginia, well, first of all, tip of the cap to Bryant. You know, I almost tweeted out late in that game, you know, Bryant just being Bryant. I mean, is there a team that plays with more toughness, more discipline, that is capable of standing up to the top competition in the middle of the field, that plays with just such pride, such an attitude? I couldn't have been more impressed. Those guys show up in their black uniforms with their black shoes. And man, they just deliver. And you could tell right away watching that game that it was going to be a dogfight. I do give Virginia credit coming off the 21-day break. Thought they'd be rusty, and perhaps they were. I think the concerns going forward for the Cavaliers, the lack of midfield scoring is just a little bit of a apparent. You know, Peter Garneau had a nice game. Aiken didn't do much. Jeff Connor didn't do much. I'm just not seeing enough from the midfield. And I thought at times the ball got bogged down in some sticks. Defensively, they're athletic. They're, you know, pretty good off the ground. I think going forward, the biggest issue for the Virginia-Georgetown game is going to be the Hoyas clearing against Virginia's ride. But this was a really good game. A lot of slippage. The field was really wet. And Virginia survives in advance. They'll have to play a step or two better to compete with Georgetown.
Logan McGovern led Bryant with three goals and an assist. Mark O'Rourke, who had 20 goals in four games since returning from myocarditis, was limited to one goal and one assist as he was matched up with by freshman Cole Kastner, who is a really interesting prospect at 6'7" out of Northern California, and Quentin Matsui, the experienced defenseman from Minnesota. Those two guys rotated on him, and I thought did a pretty nice job. O'Rourke finished the game, I believe, with 13 shots. So they definitely were under pressure, but were up to the task. Moving along, I think the third most newsworthy outcome is close to a tie between Notre Dame's 10-8 victory over Drexel and Georgetown's 18-8 victory over Syracuse that you called on Saturday night. Obviously, one game was closer than the other one. Why don't we start with the Hoyas win over the Orange, because you just mentioned they're going to be matching up against the Cavaliers in the quarterfinals.
I thought Georgetown looked terrific.
Best game of the season
because
for them.
Mainly because Syracuse decided not to slide. And, you know, all season long, I've been watching a lot of Georgetown tape, going back to their Mount St. Mary's game on that horrendous internet feed. And my question has always been, do they have primetime Dodgers? Do they have guys who can run by athletic defenders? Well, I think we found out flat and clear that the answer to that question is yes. You know, Graham Bundy draws the poll, and so he was willing to defer. But Declan McDermott was awesome, right-handed, running downhill. He's really picked it up since that Loyola loss, a wake-up call for this team. And then the freshman Dylan Hess continues to just burst through as a guy, Terry, you know, and I don't disagree with your tweets about Hess being the type of player who can be a multiple first team All-American and difference maker in the mold of a Max Sebald or a Ryan Conrad. And typically you see some freshmen fall off at the end of the year. He's going in the opposite direction. I mean, he is trending in the green big time. Loved Georgetown's defense. I love them off the ground in the defensive end, led by Gibson Smith. Owen McElroy doesn't give up any soft goals. biggest question mark moving forward is going to be clearing against Virginia, and it's going to be the lack of a second midfield, because I don't know what the weather is in Hofstra. I know it's going to be warm out in Notre Dame, and luckily your second midfield line will show up on obviously Memorial Day with a short rest, but they hardly gave a second midfield any runs. I saw Colin Monroe out there maybe once or twice. So it's the same top six on almost every possession. That's an issue going forward. We'll see if they can work that out.
You mentioned McDermott with 5 goals, Jake Caraway with 5 goals, Dylan Hess with 4, Nicky Pekovic 2-2. One addition to their depth was Zach Geddes, the short stick D-Mitty, who left the field with an injury during the Big East tournament, returned and played in this game, which is an important sign because one of the sources for their midfield depth is, can you use Hess a little bit less defensively and a little bit more offensively? And it's just kind of dependent on Geddes' availability. Jack Leary played a lot in relief, and I thought
that's
played
what
well
I was gonna
with
say.
3 ground balls and 2 caused turnovers.
That's right. Will Godin is a proven commodity, number 10, they're shorty. Geddes is one of the best in the business, if not the top guy in the country. He didn't look to be a fully functional, which is understandable. He's injured, and he didn't practice. But 16, Jack Leary, the freshman from Haverford, I thought accounted of himself quite well. So that was a positive.
What do you have to say about Syracuse as they end their season 7-5? And a lot of questions linger about the Orange program going forward.
Yeah, no, I'll leave that for the people like Brent Dax, apparently, who's written a column early this week on the future of the Syracuse program. It wasn't good. You know, I will say that guys like Stephen Rufus, Jamie Trimboli, Brett Kennedy, I was impressed with their effort and their Peter Dirth. You know, they were trying hard. There were others who kind of disappeared, and then there were others who snapped in the form of penalties and undisciplined play. And that's kind of symbolic of this Syracuse season.
Let's move earlier in the day on Saturday to South Bend, Indiana, where the Notre Dame Fighting Irish emerged 10-8 victors over Drexel. This was another one of those games where the favorite or the higher-seeded team pulled ahead early. I believe Notre Dame built a 7-3 lead, and then Drexel in the third and fourth quarters just slowly chipped away at it. The game was tied at 8-8 with about a minute and a half remaining. There was a scramble off of a Ross Blumenthal save in front of the Drexel net. A interference was called. Notre Dame restarted. Wheaton Jacobois on the left wing got underneath his man, and just a really nice high-to-high finish to put the Fighting Irish up 1. They got the ball back late. Morrison Meyer added a goal in icing the game for the 10-8 final score. In many respects, this was a survive-and-advance type game against a West Philly's finest group that just gave the Irish everything they could handle, rebounding with 4 goals to lead all scorers.
Pressure is the great equalizer. So when you take a playoff game with a strong favorite into the third and fourth quarter and make it a game, all of a sudden pressure is the great equalizer. We saw that in 3 or 4 games in round 1, where the expectation of winning is so heavily lumped towards one team, towards the favorite. That call, I don't want to get fined, but I'm not a big fan of that call. It was inconsequential to the play that was happening, the save that was made and possession that was earned. In a playoff game, I wish that some of these officials would just to kind of factor that into their decision. Was it interference? Yeah, probably. Was it meaningful interference? Absolutely not. There was absolutely not. And so I understand Drexel's frustration. I will give the Dragons a lot of credit, though. You know, you think about teams like Bryant, like Drexel, like Loyola, who have a little bit historically have shown up in these games and won them. That's something that I think that fans have to factor in when they're filling out their bracket. As far as Notre Dame's concerned, nice lead that the offense went dry in the second half. Ross the Boss Blumenthal, former camper, was strong in the second half. Interesting that Drexel scored 3 rebound goals, and we saw rebounds were a factor in the Loyola Denver game. Like, rebounds the last 3 years in the playoffs, like, accounting for more than 10% of the overall goals.
Whoa.
It's really insane. If you go back and look at my charts for these games, it's at least 1 or 2 per game. And Drexel had 3 of them. And Bowring was really good. It was a fun game to watch. And you know, now Notre Dame gets to go home and play a quarterfinal game against Maryland, which will be the heavyweight battle of the week. But they'll have to play better. They'll have to play better. This was not anywhere near an A effort for the Fighting Irish.
Just to punctuate the goalie performances, Blumenthal finished with 15 saves, and Liam Entenmann, Notre Dame's goalie, finished with 17. You mentioned the Fighting Irish host Maryland in the quarterfinals. That is set for Sunday. The Terps coming off of a victory over Vermont in College Park on Sunday afternoon, 17-11. This was a game that they led 8-4, I believe, at halftime, and got, once again, another incredible performance out of Jared Bernhardt. 6 goals and an assist. Kyle Long, 3 goals and an assist. Logan Wisnowskis, 2-1. The Catamounts were led by Thomas McConvey's 4 goals and 2 assists. And, you know, to me, this was a game that it kind of went to form, so to speak. There wasn't a whole lot that I was able to take away from it.
Well, the key in the game, down 3-2, Vermont ball with about, I don't know, .150 to go in the first quarter. Okay, they're down a goal. They played this first quarter. They haven't been great, but yet they're still in this thing. They commit just a horrendous turnover. Next thing you know, Maryland goes down and Bernhardt scores from Maltz. They win the faceoff. Kaufman scores from Maltz. They get the possession to end the first quarter, and Bernhardt scores his third. And all of a sudden, a one-goal game is 5-2. It's 3 goals in a minute and 9 seconds. And it just showed that the Vermont turnovers were going to be deadly. They had 8 in the first quarter. They finished with maybe 19 or 20 turnovers. It's more shots than they took, I think, the whole game. And so Chris Fifes has done a wonderful job, and that'll be a great learning experience. Thought Thomas McConvey was good. In terms of Maryland, this is a good win for them. Honestly, this is a team, if you look historically, they typically don't play well finals week, first round games. It's not been their round. They've played their best games of the year under John Tillman in the quarterfinals, and that's what's next. Kyle Long, I thought, was really good for the Terps. I like the defense, again, off the ground. I thought they were winning their matchups on the perimeter, but they were really good creating turnovers and then cleaning up the trash. Logan McNaney was not as sharp as he'll need to be. And then Bernhardt, you know, the shot we showed, I don't know if we showed him, but he was in the stadium, I don't know, 45 minutes after the game signing autographs. And it was as if he didn't want to leave. You know, that was his last home game. And you think about his career path, his timeline, you know, how young was he when he first came to watch his brother, Jesse and Jake? How many times has he been in that stadium as a young fan and then as a player? And that was his last game in that stadium. And I got the sense that he didn't want to walk out of there yesterday afternoon, watching him sign and sign and sign. It's like someone had to put on the shoulder, Jared, it's time to come in the locker room, say goodbye.
One other note for this game that I want to mention, Justin Shockey, 19-28 facing off against a Vermont unit led by Tommy Burke, who is an All-American level faceoff specialist over the course of the season. Luke Wehrman had taken over for Shockey down the stretch. I mean, we went from not knowing who Luke Wehrman was at midseason to seeing Luke Wehrman be Maryland's number one faceoff guy. Shockey to win 19 and pick up 10 ground balls was an important note for the Terps as they prepare to take on the Fighting Irish, for whom facing off is quite a strength.
Just one thing I'll add there, Terry, you know, the hog pen nickname for the Terp Fogos, Tyler Barbarich is kind of their faceoff coach. They got a track record of, you know, looking at statistical, like, don't judge a Maryland faceoff matchup by the stats, because they typically, when they're outmanned numerically, historically, somehow they've shown you know, the ability to say, yeah, you know what, we're gonna stand up to your great Fogo, and we're gonna win today. So, I thought they did a good initially at the beginning of the game, tying up Burke for as long as they could. They got the wings involved, and then Shockey figured it out.
Let's finish up the Sunday action. The Duke Blue Devils 16-10 winners over the High Point Panthers. This game was about Michael Sowers making his NCAA tournament debut. It was 7 scoreless minutes to open the game. Sowers got 2 quick ones. Brennan O'Neill got 1 on extra man. Sowers got a third before the end of the first quarter. High Point got one late in the first quarter. Sowers then turned into an assist machine. Going into the half, once again, High Point got another late one. It made it 10-5. Sowers had 4 goals and 4 assists. He had a hand in 8 of Duke's 10 goals. Post-game, Coach John Torpy talked about walking into the halftime tunnel with defensive coordinator Justin Tuman. They basically said, we got to shut this guy off. They did exactly that. Unfortunately, it didn't do enough to slow down the Blue Devil offense. They were able to handle that shutoff pretty effectively and turn some of the scoring load over to guys like Owen Caputo. O'Neill had a nice second half, and then Sean Lowry really contributed as well. Jake Naso had a really nice face-off performance for the Blue Devils. John Donowski talked post-game about how he continues to be impressed by the freshman. Did mention one point at which he thought he lost his cool after not getting a push call that he thought he deserved. Said that that was the first time he'd seen that out of him over the course of the season. And for High Point, Maia had a couple of timely goals. Asher Nolting led them in scoring with a goal and 3 assists. It was ironic because this was a team that had lost to Duke 27-8 on March 10th and then lost to Richmond 2 games later, 17-10, when they, in early SoCon play. From that point, they made the decision to kind of revise how they played, and they won 6 straight. If you watch the SoCon title game, you saw a High Point team that played much slower, took longer advantage of their offensive possessions. Torpy talked about how the motivation there was keeping the defense more rested so that they could play a higher pressure style when opponents did have the ball. But in this game against Duke, it was their proficiency in the transition offense, which had been the hallmark in prior years, that really contributed to their ability to at least stay somewhere within striking distance. Colin Clothier with a nice goal that stands out in my memory. But for Duke, you know, not a survive and advance type game, a little bit more like Maryland or a little bit more like North Carolina in terms of their ability to take care of business and move on. And for High Point, you know, the second NCAA tournament berth in program history and a season to be proud of after, you know, being on national TV a bunch of times in February and early March, kind of going quiet when they were reeling off all these SoCon wins and ultimately capturing a win over Richmond in the SoCon championship in order to set up this first round game against what Torpy called one of the best teams he's coached against in probably the best team he's coached against in 21 years of doing it.
I thought Duke's performance was not as impressive as others that I saw who won games by margins this weekend. You mentioned Braden Maia for High Point and Nolting. I thought they were strong. This is a High Point team who they're just not built to stop Duke. Okay. They don't have the close defense to deal with the Duke attack. And Sowers ran roughshod over them early, but this game also showed me some glaring weaknesses in this Duke team. You know, the clearing has not been good all year, and that continues to be an issue. We'll see if Loyola can come up with a ride that's got some teeth. And then the other thing is, Duke subs off on every offensive possession. They got caught running to the box. The far middy would break to the box. All 3 guys were sprinting to the box, and they gave some incredibly easy runouts to High Point and huge number advantages, whether it was directly 4-on-3s, 5-on-4s, or 6-on-5s. That was just fundamentally unsound that they will have to address in this tournament. You can't be running. If your attack's not going to dig in and ride, and Duke's not really a great riding team either, they're just fleeing the field. And I thought they left some openings. I thought Mike Adler had to make far too many quality saves in this game than you'd like. So I was more unimpressed with Duke than the majority watching this game.
Traveling back to Saturday in the second game of the day, Rutgers Scarlet Knights scored their first non-conference victory of the season, 12-5 over Lehigh in Charlottesville. Both goalies made 17 saves. That's a more impressive number for Colin Kirst, given that he only allowed 5 goals. The Scarlet Knights offense able to convert despite having a significant possession disadvantage, as Mike Sisselberger won 15 of 19 faceoffs for Lehigh. But their offense, playing without Tommy Schelling, their quarterback, really anemic, really struggled to create good looks. Cole Kirst had a goal and an assist. Justin Tiernan had two goals. Meanwhile, Rutgers offense led by Kieran Mullins, 3-2. Adam Charlambides, 3-1. And Connor Kirst, 3 goals.
Yeah, this game was completely one-sided. I thought the turning point was when Sisselberger won a draw. He had to actually play lacrosse and got an assist. And he was too tired, so he had to come out of the game. Okay, so you talk about a guy who's going to play professional lacrosse maybe one day and try out for Team USA. He's got to work on his cardio, quite honestly. I thought Rutgers was dominant. This was a really strong performance. And I give Brian Brecht the common theme of that late season loss being the wake up call. Okay, Georgetown had the late season loss. Duke had the late season loss. Rutgers had the late season loss. All beneficial in the way they played and attacked their first round games. You better have a close defense if you're going to stop Rutgers. Because Charlambides, Mullins, and Kirst are quite the combo. You know, we've talked about their age before, but the way their skills complement one another, and I couldn't have been more impressed with that trio. The midfield scoring continues to be that's going to be, you know, what determines Rutgers' success or failure. You know, Sprock, Ross Scott seems to be coming along. Shane Knobloch has kind of hit the wall. But what they did well in this game was they got the NASCAR going with the shorties. Brennan Kamish is really a capable midfielder, and Cole Daninger. And Sanguinetti did some nice things also. What stands out at the end of the day, much better defense from Rutgers and Colin Kirst. I mean, you know, I'm watching this guy all season long. And I'm saying, I think he's the best goalie in the country. It's just, it's hard to tell because the defense doesn't give him much support. And I think once again, he proved that he is the best goalie in the country, not only with the stopping, the defensive leadership, and then the ball handling and the outlet passes, whether it was from his crease, whether it was from, you know, a mobile position where he'd come out and make a little run with it. I couldn't have been more impressed with Colin Kirst, their goaltender.
Wrapping up the weekend with the first game on Saturday, North Carolina 16, Monmouth 4. This was a game that, to me, when you look at the box score and you see Colin Krieg's save total, he finished the game with 15 saves. So many of those saves are attributable to a smothering North Carolina defense that put Monmouth in a position where they had no other option other than to throw the ball at the net. These weren't saves in the traditional form. These were catching distressed shots, guys falling down, incredibly low angle, just trying to get it on net. I thought that North Carolina's defense was really smothering, both in terms of their athleticism and in terms of how much pressure they were able to apply to Monmouth when they were trying to clear the ball. They rode the ball back 4 times, again, according to the box score, but it felt like there were even more struggles from Monmouth. A couple of interesting notes. Chris Gray finished with 4 goals and 2 assists. I thought he had another nice performance, but I got to shout out Monmouth's backup faceoff specialist. Matt Sutar had been the faceoff guy for the majority of the season, or really the entire season. He struggled going 1 of 11 against Carolina's two-headed monster. Colin Bozak, a grad transfer from St. John's. You know, this is a player who was a high school class of 2014, so I believe same age as Charlambides and some of the other Rutgers players that we had spoken about. He's from Haverford, spent a year at Knapps. Like I said, played his college across to St. John's and now is doing a grad year. He hadn't taken a faceoff yet this season. He came on and won 8 of 13 draws against the Tar Heels. And Monmouth's season ends 8-3, coming off of a nice MAC championship win over Manhattan. Noah Lodi finished the game with 13 saves, had a pretty good day.
Yeah, no, I thought Carolina held serve here. Justin Anderson scoring the game, opening goal 12 seconds in. It was a great story with his wife Priscilla and their newborn baby. I thought Carolina, again, it's good to see the depth of scoring. There's just a lot of weapons there, and everybody continues to turn along and do their part, do their, you know, 1/6 or 1/10 of their offensive equation, even though Gray had the 6 points. Tanner Cook was able to rest himself and get potentially more healthy, and notable that McCarthy, their transfer midi from Princeton, did not play as well.
turning our attention to the quarterfinals. We begin in Hempstead on Saturday. We begin at noon. Virginia, the number 4 seed, takes on Georgetown, the number 5 seed, at 2:30, North Carolina versus Rutgers. Quint, what are your outlooks on those two games?
Well, all these games can be televised right now on ESPNU. I think it's interesting that they're listed as noon and 2:30. Not sure how that's possible physically, especially in a COVID era. But I guess Hofstra has 4 locker rooms. But so you're saying the second game, there'll be no warm-ups. My guess is that the start time of game 2 will be closer to 3 o'clock. That action will be called by Cotter and Clark, who will be on site. Anish and I are heading out to Notre Dame. I think all these games are intriguing. When you look at that first game or the Hofstra Regional, you know, Carolina is a strong favorite against Rutgers. The question mark there is Carolina close D against the Rutgers close attack. And then at the other end, it is Rutgers defense in general against Carolina. And Colin Kirst, Rutgers goalie, I believe will have to make 20-plus saves if the Scarlet Knights are going to win this game. Faceoffs favor Carolina. Transition game, Rutgers likes to run. But Carolina can run on Rutgers, and so I would anticipate higher scoring, lots of action.
In your games on Sunday, Duke, number 2 seed, takes on unseeded Loyola at noon, and in the second game, which, as you say, will probably start closer to 3 o'clock, the number 3 seed, Maryland Terrapins, taking on number 6, Notre Dame.
Yeah, well, you mentioned the Georgetown-Virginia game that we skipped over.
I asked that question first. You didn't respond.
No, I wasn't ready to respond. I didn't have my brackets.
Georgetown, Virginia, go ahead.
Well, Georgetown played so well and Virginia didn't. You know, the kind of skews the feeling. I think is going in, I think everyone would say, well, Virginia's a strong favorite over Georgetown. Not so fast. And Georgetown's ability off the dodge last week against Cuse, you know, Virginia wants to get in the sliding business. Georgetown's going to score some goals on the inside because Virginia's Achilles heel defensively this year has been their inside play. And, you know, guys like Dylan Watson and TJ Haley and the pick games that Georgetown will do on the inside off a two-man crease could give Virginia all sorts of problems. Faceoffs seem even. Both goaltenders are really strong. As I said earlier, Georgetown's ability to clear against the Virginia 10-man and Virginia pressure ride will be really interesting.
So two quick points. The first being, you know my attitude toward the value of playing poorly late in the season if you have secured your NCAA tournament spot. If you can get good weeks of practice leading up to the first round game and the quarterfinal game, those are worth so much relative to their value the following week in order to play well in the Final Four and if you advance in the championship game. As a result, I think that it is easier to practice well coming off of a bad performance, win or loss. Your point, Virginia, probably going to have a good week of practice. They hadn't played in 3 weeks leading up to their game against Bryant, and there's a lot that they can improve on, whether it's ground balls or some of the other elements of in-game situations that Lars Tiffany talked about as being rusty.
Yeah.
And on the flip side, Georgetown, like I, in my opinion, played its best game of the season, and you can argue maybe stole a few goals from subsequent rounds, given the fact that they put up 18 on Syracuse. The caveat there is that Dylan Watson was limited to 2 assists. Perhaps there's a more specific version of this point where certain players kind of are going to have good weeks of practice. Is Dylan Watson going to have his best week of practice because he wasn't super productive against Syracuse? And is that because matchup-wise, that is more important for beating Virginia, going to have additional benefit in terms of preparation? I don't know the answer to that,
but I think the big question there, Terry, is next week a continuation of what we saw last week, or do we just hit the reset button on a week-to-week basis now that we're in the tournament? And that's the question. You know, I think COVID, travel, hotels, it's kind of all equal here other than the Maryland-Notre Dame game. So those aren't factors. And it's interesting. Virginia will move forward, no doubt. How much is the question? Because I think they will have to take a more than a small step. The one thing about Virginia I didn't mention, Their lines kind of at times. Am I seeing Connor Schellenberger running midfield and he's on the sideline? I thought they went pretty deep for their roster at critical points in that game. I was kind of shaking my head. Like, you got to have Schellenberger and Moore on the field in a playoff game for 80-90 to 95% of the game. And I don't want to criticize a team for going deep in the roster because I'm a big believer in that. But there's a time and a place where that game was. They were losing that game. And had they lost that game, I think you go back in the tape and you're looking at, like, why are we playing X player, a non-producer, when Schellenberger's on the bench?
So this is a good opportunity for me to talk about the Media All-Americans for Inside Lacrosse are up on InsideLacrosse.com now.
Oh, are they?
Yep.
Nice.
I posted all of them, my
or
ballot.
Just first team?
No, the whole thing. I posted.
So that is voted on by media members?
That's correct. So we have all of the media members who are eligible to vote in the poll over the course of the season are eligible to vote in the All-Americans. It was voted on in midweek, so it took into account all of the regular season and conference tournament games, but did not include the first round NCAA tournament action. It debuted at halftime of that Denver Loyola game, and it, I think, has two core distinctions between the USILA All-Americans. The first is that timing function, whereas the USILA All-Americans, I believe, are also voted upon this past week, but aren't released until 2 weeks later. Oftentimes, as a result, they receive criticism because fans don't realize that, and they think that the prior 2 weeks' results should have influenced those. And then separately, we really impose the position specificity in terms of the number of players on each team, whereas ties go to everyone in the USILA vote counting metric, and then honorable mentions are added not on the basis of vote receiving, but on the basis of the committee's decision. This is a much smaller and tighter list with just three attackmen, midfielders, and defensemen in each of the top three teams. So Connor Schellenberger was probably the most difficult choice for me to make. I had him as a third team midfielder, but that, in my opinion, is based largely on the fact that he did not play either solely attack or solely midfield. Had he played solely attack, he would have put up more than 55 points. And when you stacked his production against some of the guys who I had on first and second team, particularly probably Brendan Nickturn, I would have had Schellenberger as a second team attackman, but his numbers didn't stack up. So then when you compare him to the midfielders, and his numbers are considerably better than a lot of the offensive midfielders, it's hard to give him full credit because he's playing so much attack that he's going to score more. Attackmen score more than midfielders. It is just a fact of the game that has been true forever. And so he really truly is, you know, there are a lot of guys who are listed as midfielders but play attack. Connor Kirst is one of them. I think Brennan O'Neill was another one.
No, Connor Kirst was erroneously listed as midfielder. He has not run a single shift in midfield this
exactly.
season.
So that is a problem. And then there are other problems where and he was someone who was listed as a midfielder because that's what he played at Villanova and then transferred to Maryland and they never reassigned his position. To Rutgers. He played attack the whole year.
Do you know he took a bunch of faceoffs
at Villanova?
At Villanova as a freshman? Like 90.
Yeah. There's a Lyle Thompson-esque comparison in terms of the evolutionary arc of his position status. The other kind of scenario like this is the guy who kind of converts from a midfielder to an attackman over the course of the season because of the role that he needs to play on his team. Tom Schreiber is someone who stands out in my memory. His senior year, by the end of the year, he was not leaving the field. He was on the field
An attackman. Yeah, he was an attackman. He didn't play defense, and he was on the field as an attackman for faceoffs.
Connor Schellenberger is someone who plays both.
A true slash, Terry. I do agree with you. It's a great point. His distinction is extremely hard. Really, it is. And I've seen a ton of Virginia games.
The reason for that is because you don't want to take Ian Laviano or Peyton Cormier off the field any more than you want to take Schellenberger off the field. They are, I mean, this is where you get into sets and tactics. they don't initiate as much. Certainly Leviano, Cormier can initiate a little bit in a two-man game, but not nearly the pure initiator that Schellenberger is. The question that clearly Sean Kerwin, the offensive coordinator for Virginia, is trying to answer is, can we get this up top, down low, yin-yang complement between Moore and Schellenberger, where each guy can do similar things, and so we're creating pressure on the defense from both angles on the field? And I think against Bryant, you saw that. Now, granted, I don't think Bryant's defensive approach is going to be duplicated by very many opponents going forward, although it was successful to the extent that maybe it would be interesting to see Rutgers try to throw this box invert zone at Virginia. But I think ultimately that is why Schellenberger is running out of the box more. I think your main point is,
yeah,
there shouldn't be more than a couple of possessions that he's not on the field.
Yeah, no, that just that catches my eye, honestly, because I think he's in a super elite player. But and I understand what they're trying to do, create matchups, using two-man games to create positive switches in their favor. If Moore and Schellenberger are both on the field to start, they're both covered by poles. And if they work together behind the net, then you have switches, pole, pole. Nothing gained by bringing Schellenberger top. There's a chance he may draw a shorty more easily. It just creates potentially more options. I get it. I totally get it. So, again, you're right. Their coaching staff's right. What I see is not deceiving me, but it's just kind of more like a pet peeve. You know, you're losing a game to Bryant by two, and I'm seeing that you're not bringing the best guys out on the field every shift. It's like, whoa, okay. So, but that has payoffs. Like Lars Tiffany knows what he's doing. That has payoffs going forward. If you do win a game like that and you're able to play a lot of personnel, that helps going forward. The later you can shrink your bench in a season, the better.
Are you ready to talk about Duke Loyola and Maryland Notre Dame?
Yeah, you know, it's the Duke Loyola rivalry. Gosh, I was thinking about it driving my daughter to school today. Like, that was it 2013 when Mathias scored late in the game at Duke in the playoffs, and Jack Runkel falls into the mud. And like, that's a game that was so memorable for me just because of the images. And Loyola was the defending champs.
Don't forget about the timeout. Don't forget about the timeout.
No, the timeout. Exactly. The drama involved in that game was amazing. Loyola's the defending champs. Duke would go on to win it. It was an incredible, that was a first round game, correct?
Correct.
Yeah, and Duke goes on and wins the title. That was probably the hardest playoff game. Charlie Toomey's timeout, which, you know, came up last week when Kevin Warren took the timeout against Denver. He even mentioned that and how he felt and how Charlie must have felt. And gosh, how can you not love Charlie Toomey with what he's been through this season and what he's been able to accomplish in his career, 16 years now at Loyola, but this year in specifically. That's a highly underrated staff as well, with Coach Van Arsdale, Coach Dewan, and Coach Vakeness. So, you know, it's amazing. Here I am again this week, quarterfinals, like calling Ryan, their SID up on the phone, like, hey, can I come over and watch practice? I don't think that's going to happen this year, but it's I've made that trip a lot more than I've made over to Homewood in the last decade. I tell you that much.
The question, obviously, is can Loyola be, as John Torpy called it, potentially the best team of all time? You rightly point out this is not a perfect Duke team. I struggle now that they are on, I believe, a 5-game win streak to really diagnose how and why Loyola is winning these games. And we really didn't give Aiden Olmstead as much credit as he deserved as Loyola's leading scorer with 5 goals in this game. He has played a lot better down the stretch. He's their leading scorer. He had 50 points. But in the middle of the season, he was pretty anemic by comparison. He got moved from attack to midfield. Again, one of those situations where the staff was trying to change up the matchups that they were able to get. And yesterday, he didn't really score nearly as much as a Dodger. He scored a lot more as a feet set shooter, and then he scored one that the ball flew out of his stick and got tapped into the goal by a Denver defenseman. That is just one of those goals that makes you feel like this could potentially be our day. And in a 1-goal game, it was the difference. So pretty ridiculous from that standpoint. But Loyola is neither going to be afraid, as you pointed out, nor are they going to go away if Duke builds a 6-2 lead at some point in the first or second quarter. The question is, can they win?
Yeah, they can win. They can win. They could win. There's no doubt if they continue to play the way they're playing right now, if they can scrap and claw on faceoffs, their shot making has been so timely, and the defense seems to be getting better, and they bring in a hot goalie. They'll have the underdog attitude, which will be beneficial. You know, I haven't had a Loyola game, I don't think, since 19, because I'm looking at a board I made back in 19, Terry, and I want to go through the lineup real quick, just to kind of put it all together, how bizarre this is. So I got Charlie Toomey in his 14th season. Loyola was 11-4 out of the Patriot League. So I'm guessing that's 2019 playoffs.
The Syracuse
attack
game?
Of Spencer Armstead and
the
Lindley.
The quarterfinal game against Penn State?
Yeah, that's what it is. Spencer, Olmstead, and Lindley. Okay, they got 2/3 of that attack back. That's a huge team strength. A midfield of Duffy, Brown, and Scanlon. Well, we know that story. Then I got guys like Riley Cox. He's gone. Peter Swindell, he's still there. And he's been a barometer player in my eyes.
Yep.
Alex McGovern, he's left the house. I actually saw him on Friday at the Black Eyed Susan. Logan Devereaux, he's at Denver. Dan Wigley, sophomore, number 27, two-handed kid. He's like a big-time player now for them, correct?
Yeah, he had injuries in the middle of the season. He hasn't produced, but he's drawn slides.
Then you got Matt Higgins, who I think is outstanding. Ryan McNulty, who's outstanding. A defense of Wires, Vellante, and Johnson. Well, there's one remaining Wires. Goalies, Jacob Stover. Other shorties you may see, Peyton Rezonka, freshman from San Diego. So there's some faces. There's some guys with some lineage. And also there's, you know, some star power that has left the building.
And there are two injured starters in Joey Kamish and Kyle LeBlanc, who are not playing in this game. This is a Greyhound team that has just managed to find talent. One guy that I think fans should be aware of is Seth Higgins, who, if our box score is updated, which I'm not certain whether it is, he has 3 goals and 6 assists. But if you've watched their last 3 or 4 games, number 24 has been instrumental in some of their production. And then Evan James, number 32, has
really
floated
nice
between attack and midfield based on his injury status and Kamish's subsequent leaving of the offense. I mean, it's just been, they have rotated probably 5 or 6 guys through the attack over the course of the last 4 games, and it's just created a lot of sparks. But it's the same time, it's created a lot of who's that and what's that guy doing there.
No, exactly. I watched their Georgetown. Were you at the Georgetown?
I was at the
Georgetown game. I was watching it on TV, and the whole time I'm saying, like, how's Loyola going to score? And they muck it up and just scrap and they get a goal. It's like, wow, okay. I felt the same way watching them yesterday. Like, dodging traction and dodging success is not very easy for this group, but they don't let it get them down, and they work the ball pretty late in the shot clock. But they're timely shooting late in the shot clock, and, you know, down to 15, and you know the guy going to the goals, like, it's either him or one pass, because this thing's got to mature here. This possession has to mature now. And so many times in recent games, they've been clutch.
Maryland Notre Dame. Let's end with the heavyweight showdown. Jack Kielty on Jared Bernhardt?
Oh, yeah. Kielty on Bernhardt. I would think the matchup at the other side is
going to be Cohen on Wisnoskis.
Grill on Kavanaugh. Probably put Rahill on York. This will be a good game. Notre Dame's going to have to play better. The faceoff matchup will be interesting. The goaltend battle is intriguing. Notre Dame's issue in their losses this year, and it showed up against Drexel, is clearing late in the game. I'm not sure they're in elite condition. They seem to get sloppy in their clearing in the fourth quarter. It's going to be hot. It's going to be 86 degrees in South Bend on Sunday.
Oof.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Good luck getting hotel rooms if you're a fan. Okay, here's the deal. It's graduation at Notre Dame. So even I'm staying 25 minutes outside of town, east of South Bend. So I'm laying in Midway, and I got to drive like 2 hours.
I just did that
hotel
on Wednesday. Don't complain. I did an out and back. I did an out and back to Midway. Drove to Culver. Oh, I know.
Good news is that Southwest still has some tickets available on a bunch of these Saturday flights, and you can get out of Midway Sunday night. Hopefully, knock on wood, at 8:25 or 9:40 to get you back to BWI. So, I grabbed my flights last week before the Terps win. So this is a possible trip, Terry. I hope you're doing both, because you could easily get from LaGuardia to Chicago on Sunday morning. I see no reason why IL can't dip into the coffers and send some live reporters to these games.
Quint, that'll do it for this edition of the Quick Restart Podcast, unless you've got anything else you want to shout out.
No, I don't. This weekend was super enjoyable. Doing these games from home, seeing fans back at the games was outstanding. I just want to send a shout out to all my teammates, whether, Sheehan, he or she is working a men's playoff game. Super cool to see that. Monaco, the play-by-play guy, did a really nice job. Matt Ward fought through a sore throat. And then, of course, the knuckleheads, Cotter Kark and Anish. My guys, it was fun. And we take the step forward now.
That'll do it for this edition of the Quick Restart Podcast. If you like what you heard, leave a rating and a review. Tell a friend. Hit us up on social media. He's at Hugh Kesnick. I'm at Terrence Foy. We are at @inside_lacrosse. We will be back later in the week with more Inside Lacrosse podcasts.
I need a theme song this week. I need a theme song this week, Foy. Have the fans send me a theme song on Twitter. What's that one song that's going to get us in the mood this week? We are whistle ready at the Quick Restart Podcast. Like that? Whistle ready.